morning, everyone. So we're going to call this morning's talk Putting the Fun in Dysfunction. That's our family motto. I think it's the case with many of us. We had the opportunity to do a study on 5,200 Orthodox Jews. We did it in two stages. The first stage was we studied 1,700. That was before the crash of 2008-2009. Then we did a study on 3,500 others. What's fascinating about this study is that those who are divorced, that basically demarcated certain factors in their marriages, the issues that broke them, they were the very same factors that those of us who are married set our issues in our marriage, our challenges and problems in our marriage. Now, in this study, we ask people, how long are you married? Is it a first marriage or is it a second marriage? Are you Sephardic, Ashkenazi, Balei Tshuva from birth, Lubavitch, Hasidic, Yeshivish, modern? So we have a series of micro-categories. What I'm going to share for the most part is on a macro level. I want to start out with the good news. The good news essentially is this, that 62%, I apologize, 74% of the men and 72% of the women said that they would, if they had to define their marriage, they would rate it as either excellent or very good. 74 and 72. Why is that significant? Americans across the board, all stripes and face, when asked the exact same question, 62% of men and 59.5% of women would rate their marriage as excellent or very good. So that's the good news. I wish I could look at you in the face and say that 98% of our couples view their marriage as excellent or very good. But relative to Americans as a whole, it's very positive. And then of those who were married, of the 5,200, 80% said, if I could do it all over again, I would marry the same spouse. Keep in mind, this is a private, in other words, you're not saying this publicly. This, you have autonomy, you have privacy, so that's very good. I wasn't brought here this morning to share the good news. You know, we're Jews. We like to obsess on the bad news. I mean, I don't know if you heard this week. The whole focus has been on Brexit. The whole focus has been on the LeBron James bringing back to Cleveland, finally the championship since 1964. I don't know if you heard what happened in Israel this week. Did you hear? You know, they discovered a dinosaur in Israel this week. You didn't hear that? Up on the Golan Heights. They named it a Brontosaurus. Because we're Jews, we love to obsess on the tsars. That's what our talk is about. It's not about the 74 and 72. So let's talk about the challenges. Because the reality is we can learn from the challenges. There are six factors. And we're going to use, you know, we're going to quote a number of Rebbeim, Talmidei Chachamim, we're going to quote a number of therapists. This is one of the Gedolim of late night television. We're going to use his methodology, David Letterman. Remember the 10, 9, 8? So there were six factors, okay, that 15% or more of us said were challenges in our marriage. Six factors. And we're going to start with six and work our way up. Number six was the following. It was the issue of religious differences. By the way, amongst those who said they were Balei Tshuva, this was much higher, much more significant. But on a macro level, 6% said religious differences. You know, when a couple gets married, sometimes they're not thinking about what will be 10, 20 years down the road. They're not taking into account adolescent children. Number two is, none of us are fixed. We all develop, we all evolve as human beings throughout time. Who I am today is not who I was 15 years ago. So here's the problem. If there were no kids in the factor, okay, you keep Shabbos this way, I keep it that way. You're willing to eat here, I'm not willing to eat there. You'd like to go to the following place for vacation, I'm not comfortable in that kind of thing. We can work that out. You add children to the mix, and keep in mind, there's no one like an adolescent child that can take any daylight and drive a wedge. Where do we want to send the kid to school? What kind of school? Where will we eat? You know, what kind of restaurant is okay to eat in? how are we going to dress on vacation? What are we going to do Shabbos when we're on vacation? So again, it's very different. It's a very different discussion if it's a husband and wife. When you have kids in the mix, it's a real, real challenge. So religious differences was, that was number six. Number five, more than religious differences, was issues of intimacy, the bedroom. And what was fascinating here, there were objective answers, and then there were subjective, you could fill in things. So we, those of us who teach brides and grooms, very often make a huge mistake. We focus very well, in fact, the education on Taharas and Mishpacha is fairly solid. But the component of the Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha, the component of Ona, Simen Reish Mem in Orach Chaim, intimacy, foreplay beforehand, afterplay, the epilogue afterwards, where the Ramban, the Menorah Samaor, there's a lot of material on this. That never gets touched with a young man or a young woman. And we saw the ramifications of that in this study. I'll give you one example of that. Many women wrote in, I feel like an object, not like a subject. Because what does everyone do? Everyone shares the Gemara of Rabbi Meir. By the way, till this day, I happen to have a pretty good relationship with Dr. Ruth Westheimer. She always quotes Rabbi Meir to Jewish and non-Jewish clients. And she says, you should know, 40 years ago, as sex therapists, we were looked at as quacks, as crazy. Today, mainstream family therapists, when there's something which is boring or dull in the marriage, very often they'll employ forced abstinence, what you and I call Taharas HaMishpacha. It's employed throughout the psychological community, Ruth told me. So everyone will quote you Rebbe Meir. You know, the whole experience on the mikveh night, it'll be a date night, it's like the honeymoon syndrome all over again. Right? But what they don't quote you is the, well, primarily the Sephardic Rishonim, but a number of the Moneh HaMitzvos. When they look at Taharas HaMishpacha, and again, I'm putting the Surgeon General's warning, you and I know the reason we observe any mitzvah is because it's a command of the divine. It's because God told us to do it. But there's this institution called Tamei HaMitzvos, not why God told us to do it, God forbid. It's not why, it's what we get out of it. Tam from the word taste or flavor. How do I relate to it? How do I experience the mitzvah? So everybody quotes Rabbi Meir. And by the way, we have studies that back up what Rabbi Meir said. If I had a better scientific source, believe me, I would give it to you, but I don't, so I can only give you what I have. And that's Cosmopolitan magazine. They did a study. The x-axis is how many times a month is a couple intimate. That was the y-axis. Intimacy per month. The x-axis is the duration of the marriage. What do you think the graph looks like? Again, the y-axis is how many times a month are we intimate. The x-axis is the duration of the marriage. What do you think the graph looks like? Everybody will say, mm-hmm. It's a hyperbole. Sorry about that. It's a hyperbole. There's nothing hyperbolic about Clint Eastwood. So, you have the following. They did a study in Israel. Now keep in mind, in Israel, it's not just the Orthodox who keep Taharas HaMishpacha. You have many Moroccan families, many Yemenite, many Iraqi families, who may not keep Shabbos the way you keep Shabbos, but they're very serious about Taharas HaMishpacha. I'll give you an example. I was the rabbi for 10 years in Beverly Hills. At our mikvah in Beverly Hills, there was always a lineup of black Mercedes driving to mikvah on Friday night. You had Persian women. Okay. They were not Shomer Shabbat the way that you're Shomer Shabbat, but mikvah, very serious about it. And they would drive to mikvah and go to mikvah Friday night. And we dealt serious issues with poskim. You know, issues with the length of the nails and all these issues, because we didn't want to turn them away. We wanted to encourage them to keep mikvah. So they did a study in Israel. The y-axis and the x-axis. Yes, you had hyperbole, but instead of it going like this, it went like this. Meaning, 8, 10, 14, 20, 25 years into marriage, much more sexually active than those who do not observe Taharas HaMishpacha. So I don't have to prove Rabbi Meir, nor do you need proof for it. Here's where I want to go in a different direction. What Rebbe Meir was teaching us is that the period of abstinence is a prelude. It's a means to an end when the couple can be together to keep the marriage dynamic and fresh. This is what the Moneh HaMitzvah is saying. Look at the period of abstinence as an end in itself, not as a means to an end. Meaning what? There's a time which is Mukdash. And I'll use the example of what Shabbos is for us as individual Jews, as families. What is the holidays? It's a time for nation building. Okay? What is Shemitah, the sabbatical? It's a time to grow and develop intellectually. So there's a period of the month for that marriage. The focus is not going to be, so to speak, the intimacy. It's not like he's going to fill her car up with gas on a cold winter night because that's the beginning of foreplay and that's the plans, you know, for a rendezvous later in the night. No, no, no. There's no carrot at the end of the stick. The focus of this period of the month is the reason why we got married in the first place. This is what the Sephardic Rishonim say. To have a time which is mukdash for intellectual growth, for the meeting of two minds, for emotional growth. We're going to go for a walk for one reason, because we want to talk to each other. Not because it's the beginning of what I would like later in the evening. We're going to go out for coffee or for dinner because we want to talk about issues other than paying the bills, you know, carpools and diapers. And what we found, particularly from the women, is that from men, that time of the month, stay later at work, stay later in the Beis HaMedrash. They're working on their basketball fantasy league, and they're up, you know, watching the West Coast game on ESPN. In other words, instead of putting more time and more of a focus on developing the psychological and intellectual relationship, again, I want to quote what a number of women wrote in. You know, when I'm good for something, then he's there. He makes me feel like an object, not like a subject. There are many other aspects, but this was one of the macro aspects of number five. More than religious differences and intimacy issues, number four, and personally, I'm not speaking on behalf of the survey, but as a rabbi, I found this is the biggest challenge of all six. Because the others are huge challenges, but they're something that can be worked out through therapy. This is not so simple. Boundary issues. Boundary issues. And if I could use an example, imagine what we learned when we were children in school. You have a solar system. The sun is the middle. And then you have the various planets that orbit around the sun, various concentric circles. What's the nimshel? A husband and wife are the sun and their dependent children. What orbits around them? Married children, parents, siblings, the shul community, the day school community. We're here in Teaneck, the Bergen County Jewish community, Klal Yisrael, America. We all have in our life a nucleus and concentric circles that orbit around the nucleus. Imagine this. Instead of one nucleus, imagine nuclei banging and competing for each other. You're going on a vacation. You're not taking me with. What do you mean? Do you know how I sacrificed for you? I work two jobs, your father worked two jobs. You're not going to take me with on a vacation? That issue. Something more basic. Today, in the world we live in, look, in a perfect world, we would encourage our kids, if they're not going to make Aliyah, to move to Cleveland, to Kansas City, to Jacksonville. These are outstanding, fine, emerging Jewish communities. But no, we're New Yorkers. You know the Norman Rockwell. You know, you got 10th Avenue, 11th Avenue, New Jersey, Pacific Ocean, and China, right? It's all one avenue. So what happens? We want our kids living close. And I'm not blaming anyone. What happens? To live in a place like New York, to live in a place like Los Angeles, to live in a Boston, especially in an Orthodox community. So by definition, if you want your children marrying young, you want grandchildren, which is something we all encourage, what happens? The only way it works is if the in-laws are an ATM machine. By becoming an ATM machine, by definition, psychologically, But it's a definition. You're inhibiting that growth. Whether your kids are learning in COLA, whether your kids are in med school, whether your kids are studying for a PhD, it's irrelevant. But psychologically, you're not allowing for their autonomy and independence. And I'm not here to blame anyone. There are many things we can point blame at. This is the existence of living in a frum community with the Orthodox text. I mean, do you understand the average American wedding has somewhere between 120 and 135 guests? If you don't invite 500 people to your wedding, you're antisocial, you're harmless, right? Think about our world. Think about the real estate tax that exists. I'm not talking about the tax to TNEC or to anyone. I'm talking about just living in an Orthodox community, the day school tax. So by definition, what we're doing is we're setting up that tension. Now it gets worse. If I were to ask for a show of hands here, I think any of us who are 40 and older, fair to say that 30 to 40% of us are children of survivors. Okay? Think about anyone who grew up in a home where one or more of the parents were survivors. There's a person who lives here in our community, Johnny Crew. You all know Dr. Johnny Crew. Johnny told me he had the curse and the blessing of getting his PhD in the late 70s in psychology. What did he do it on? He's a child of survivors. His wife Phyllis is. He did it on separation anxiety among survivors. When the kid goes to college, they didn't allow their children to sleep over at a college. Or when the kid gets married, or when it's time for the kid to go to graduate school and they have to leave home. It's not that they were at, you know, the far side of the bell curve. Survivors were off the bell curve, and it's understandable. You had a first family. And they killed your children. You watch your children being butchered. How are you going to raise this child? Or another scenario. The last time you saw your mother or father, they looked at you in the eyes and they say, whatever you do, please, you've got to save your younger sibling. Swear to me and promise your brother alive. And you did everything you could. And you did miracles. And what did you end up with? There was no way you could keep that child alive. Now, that survivor raises a kid. How do you think they treat that child? You know what that child is? That child's a China doll. You take a China doll, you stick it in a cabinet, you lock the cabinet with a key and throw away the key. Because God forbid, if you drop that China doll, it could crash and break into 1,000 pieces. The children of survivors, our generation, now how do you think we raise our kids? The way we were raised. So separation issues, boundary issues in our community are very significant. And I'll tell you, it's not unique to the Ashkenazi. Look at the Persian Jews. We interviewed many Persian Jews for this. Look at the Sephardic Jews. You're not eating Friday night dinner with us? You're not going to be with us for Seder? You're not going to break the fast, Yom Kippur? Why don't you just take a cleaver and cut my heart out right now and cram it down my throat, because that's what you're doing. The shrew, you haven't been married 8 months to that shrew, and now she's poisoned you against us. This is for not coming to Friday night. By the way, we can laugh about it, but it's real. It's real. Boundary issues were worse than intimacy issues, more significant in our community, and more significant than religious differences. Number three, and I think the question we would all ask about number three is, we would have guessed it would have been number one, but it was actually number three, were financial challenges. I don't think we have to spend a lot of time on that, it's obvious. There's someone here in this community, I don't know the name, but they have a blog, 200K Chump. You've heard of that? It's fascinating. Here they are. It's a couple. They're in the fourth percentile of all American earners. They didn't buy a house in Teaneck because that was too expensive. So they had to get a little house in Bergenfield. They don't get a new the Honda Odyssey every 3 years. They've got the old clunker that's now 9-10 years old. They've got four kids. Tuition, you're looking at $87,000 in tuition. They're making over $200,000 in the fourth percentile of all Americans, and they can't make it. You don't have to say more. And that's the challenge. And by the way, what the psychologists would tell us is the following. We as human beings, you know, in all ways we are God's greatest creation. But one that's fascinating is, psychologically and emotionally, we have the ability to figuratively overcome a nuclear bomb. I mean, you look in every community we exist in, look at the role the survivors played in being role models to us, building our institutions, whether it's our day schools, our shuls. They came here with nothing. You know, the American Jews were already middle class. And look at what the survivors did to build our communities. And we have to have profound gratitude to them. So we all tell those stories, right? We can all tell those stories. But what about another example? You have here a scenario where a parent, God forbid, loses a child. They have to bury their own child. Any of us who've been in a wedding, a funeral, I apologize, watching the parents bury their own child. I mean, it's a human being's worst nightmare. But yet we observe them, and we see that they'll never be the same. They will always have ghosts that haunt them. They will always have scar tissue. But we watch them rebuild their lives. We watch them continue to be parents to the other siblings. We watch them continue to build our communities. And it's astounding. So figuratively, going back to what I said before, figuratively, we have the ability to rebound from a psychological nuclear attack. You know what the psychologists teach us? What the human being cannot withstand? The human being cannot overcome? Chronic stress. Chronic stress is where it's day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out. That destroys a person. It destroys a marriage. The greatest example of chronic stress is what? We don't know how to make ends meet. We just don't. And that is a real challenge. Number two, more than religious differences, more than intimacy issues related to the bedroom, more than boundary issues, more than financial stress. Number two, 22%, actually 21.5% of all the 5,200 who were interviewed, 21.5% said this was a challenge in their marriage. Time. Now, if I could take a step back, you and I as Americans, I don't want to say as Jews, but as Americans, you and I have been lied to. You and I have been, there's been a hoax that has been perpetrated against all of us. And you know what that is? It's the lie known as quality time. I work a job where I have to be in touch with financial markets 24/5. Okay? Where I have operations for our company, which is a global company, on 5 to 6 continents. And that means there's no such thing as Saturday, Sunday, because what's Sunday here, it's already the work day in China and Asia. But don't worry. You know why? I'm going to take our son out once every 2 weeks. We're going to go to the teenage doghouse and watch the football games or watch the basketball game. We're going to have bonding time. Or we're going to go on a date night once every 3 weeks. You know why? Quality time. And by the way, it wasn't his fault. He bought into the nonsense they were feeding him. I remember Rabbi Riskin used to talk about that. When he was setting up Ephrats, and he was all over the world trying to raise money for his institutions, and he always talked about this quality time. It's a lie! Sheker v'chazav. It's garbage. There's no such thing. You can't substitute for quantity time. And the therapists tell us that. Rav Herschel Shechter, the Rosh Kola, he said it, I saw it subsequently in other achronim. Fascinating term that Torah uses for the obligation, the conjugal obligation that a husband has to his wife. Ona, right? There's share, ksut, and ona. What's the problem? Ona literally means, what does I involve nun hey? Translate that word. Time. It's a strange term. The rabbis have these beautiful euphemistic terms to be referring to intimacy. Bia, tashmish. They're these euphemistic, clean terms referring to intimacy. How come God? How come the Torah didn't use a term like that? What is Onan? So Rosh Hashanah said, what the Almighty was teaching us is the following. The primary chiyuv, the primary obligation that a spouse has to their spouse is to be there. To be there. Not quality time, to be there, quantity time. And that came out in the survey. Think about those of you who commute into the city. I can tell you, if I don't leave at 6 a.m. or I don't leave at 9:30 a.m., our offices are on Wall Street, I'm looking at an hour and a half commute. And if I leave at 6, I mean, if I don't see the kids, or I leave at 9:30, then it's only 55 or 60 minute commute. You want to come home and not sit in traffic for an hour and 45 minutes? Can't leave the city before 8:30 from Wall Street. What kind of a life do you have? You may be very good and very successful in terms of your work world, in terms of your work life, but what kind of a life do you have with your spouse, with your children? And this is the problem of quantity time. And by the way, thank God that there's an Isser Malacha. Because what would happen when we're home? The other nights of the week, we're not there. When we're there, we're addicted to the iPhone, addicted to the Samsung, right? You're addicted to the markets, to work, to whatever, to the texting, to this, to that. At least on a Friday night, we look at each other. We read each other's body language. We make eye contact at least once a night, once a week. This is a challenge in our community. And number one, 23%, more than religious differences, more than intimacy issues, more than boundary issues, more than financial issues, more than not spending time with each other. Number one was communication. Communication issues. So I'm going to share with this. This was interesting because the feedback we got from the women was very different than from the men. The men said the following. They asked the simple, you know, I asked a simple yes or no question, and she gives me a PhD thesis. The women, you know, women, we all learn Pirkei Avos. We all learn Parshas Bereishis. That, you know, that there's this concept called the other, Homo sapien, is B'Tselem Elokim. What makes us B'Tselem Elokim? So the Targum Onkelos there, Onkelos teaches us. Ruach Mamalah, we have the ability to communicate abstract ideas. So women found that's true with the female gender. But with males, whether it's sheep, whether it's bulls, whether it's Homo sapiens, all you get is a grunt. Now, if it's your birthday or your anniversary, you might get a phrase, but don't expect the full sentence. Don't expect a paragraph. Come on. And that's a problem. Women complained. My husband is not effusive. My husband is not articulate. You know, there's a term called a caveman. It's not referring to antiquities. It's referring to us. We don't communicate. We don't articulate. And I'll use an example. I think it's very fair. There's a book you're all familiar with, and it's something you should each have on your Svarim shelves. You have your Shas, your Rambam, your Tanakh, and next to that you need to have John Gray's Men Are From Mars, Women From Venus. Everyone should have that. Read it once a year. I'm serious about that. The therapist will tell you it's not the best book psychologically, but why did the therapist recommend that book? Because what's the purpose of reading any book? It's to take from the book and to take it with you and use it and employ it in life. So I'm going to use an example from that book. It's called Mr. Fix It. I'll use this example. He's had a bad day. Tough day at work. He's cut off. The secretary didn't do what she was supposed to do. The client stiffed him up. He's not in a great mood either. But he's going to be inside. When he walks in that door, he's going to try his best to be there for his wife and children. He walks in. He looks at his beloved, his soulmate. And he sees Mount St. Helens about to erupt. And he's thinking to himself, what did my mother say to her dad? He says, honey, what's the matter? She's not talking. Honey, what's the matter? So they sit down. And she starts to unload. And what does he do? Mr. Fix-It. What does he do? He's going to explain to her, well, you know, sure enough, by the way, it was his mother, and it was this, and it was that. And he's like a surgeon. like a Talmud Chacham breaking down a sugya. He's telling her they should say this to that and do this differently. And in the middle of this, you know, he's really being mitzantzen himself. He's holding back his own needs. And he wants to be there for his wife. And in the middle of this, Mount St. Helens really does corrupt. Will you just be quiet, please, and listen? What did he say? What did he say? What he didn't realize, if she needed somebody to solve her problems, she got her IQ is 20 points higher than this thing back. You know, he didn't just need him. You know what she wanted? She wanted empathy. Give me a hug. Or at least when you sit down, demonstrate, you know, with your shoulders, with your body, demonstrate empathy. She doesn't want someone to solve her problems. She just needs to talk. She needs to unload. She needs to unwind. And I'm speaking now as, you know, the caveman. I blame all the women out there. It's your fault. And I'll tell you why. You think, what did you say? You think because you went through this 11 other times where you had the exact same scenario, you think we get it? Why would you make such a stupid assumption? We don't get it. We're cavemen. You know what I'm saying? We're very, if it's financial markets, if it's a sugya and shas, that we get. But you're talking about emotions and touchy feeling. We don't get that stuff. So, what, you know, we lived out in Beverly Hills. So, we used to say in Hollywood, take two, do this scenario. He walks in, and she's going to say, honey, I know you. You're going to want to solve all my problems. You want to explain why I should do this and how I should do that. Listen, just listen. Just hear me out. Just let me unload, please. And just demonstrate with your body language and demonstrate empathy. That's what I need. If you would tell us that, maybe, just maybe, we might get it right. So going back to the survey. There's total disconnect. Women have complained that we, as men, are not effusive. We don't articulate. We don't demonstrate empathy. We don't reflect verbally, you know, emotions, and that's a real challenge. And men, of course, as we said at the beginning, feel that women demonstrate too much emotion, for, you know, in terms of their articulation. Total disconnect there. That was 23%. But taking a step back, the overall news is quite good. 74 and 72, men and women, excellent or very good marriage, relative to 62 and 59 and a half. 80% said they would do it all, if they could do it all over again, they would marry the same spouse. I wish I could look you in the face and tell you it was 99 or 98%. It's not. We have a long way to go. But relative to the world we live in, it is very positive. But what we found from this study was, what we found at least, we shared this with rabbis, we shared this with mental health professionals, the reality is, we were able to identify what are the challenges. And I'm going to make a comment that is not coming from this study. Okay, I want to be honest with you. Because I'm not a therapist, okay? And I shouldn't, you know, Clint Eastwood used to say, a man's got to know his limitations, right? Talk about gavul and boundaries. I would say this. Communication skills can be worked on. It's not easy. It's extremely difficult. That can be worked on. Time, it's an issue of reorganizing one's life. And it may mean that other parts of our lives suffer. It may have ramifications to the job or to our finances. But that's something we can work on. We have the ability, if we make concerted effort. What I think is a real challenge, though, is the boundary issue. Because I think it's inherent to our community. I know I'm running over, so I want to wrap it up. But the boundary issue is a real challenge because to make it in America today, and look at it, what you saw this week in Brexit, what's happening in Europe also, you just have a transformation of what it takes to make it in the workplace. Not just to make it, but to thrive in the workplace. It's a different economy. The global economy, the technological economy is a different economy. And because of that, we need our children to have a kind of education and preparation and training. They may not be earning a decent salary until they're 30 to make it in that world. The problem is we don't want them getting married at 35. They don't want to get married at 35. And because of that, there's always going to be this tension. That we're funding them, But at the same time, you can't say, you know, you're good enough to be an ATM machine, but you're not good enough to say where we send the kids to school. You're not good enough to say where we're going to spend Pesach. It doesn't work that way. And there's an inherent tension. So I think number four is not so simple. I don't think it's one that's going to be solved in the short run or the medium run. The others, you know, with the help of the right therapist and with the couple that really wants to make it work, I think that what the survey did was at least it gave us a little bit of an insight into, so to speak, putting what we call the fun in dysfunction. Thank you very much.